Welcome to the Tapped In Podcast, a production of Bellingham Tap Trail. Tapped In covers the people, news, and events in and around the Bellingham craft beer scene. I'm Dave Morales, and I'll be your host for today's episode. In late April, I sat down with Eric Jorgensen, brewer at the North Fork Brewery and Beer Shrine in Deming, Washington. We had a good time chatting about things like the beer that flipped the switch, favorite styles and ingredients, and bears. Yeah, bears. The unedited conversation clocked in around 2 hours, so we were a little bit loose by the end of it. Enjoy. All right, well, let's jump into it. You are Eric Jorgensen, head brewer out at the North Fork Brewery in Deming, Washington. Tell us a bit about your humble beginnings. What was your trajectory to where you are now? You know, 'cause you've been there for, what, 15 years?
No.
No.
June 2000 was when I took over brewing fully.
Okay.
So
17 years.
17
almost,
plus. Coming up. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know. However that works.
Right.
Yeah, you talking beginning homebrew?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like obviously you started out as a homebrewer as almost, well, not these days, not everybody does. People go to school and come out and, you know, ready to go work for Miller Coors, but we're old enough to where you got into it through rabid homebrewing. Yeah. And you started brewing in Alaska or were you in Washington?
I discovered the fact that you could homebrew in Alaska because I grew up in Alaska. I was born in Alaska. I guess my first experiences with homebrew would be, or the moment when I realized that it was a possibility, was at a party in Anchorage, which is far away from where I grew up, as far as like, I wouldn't just normally be in Anchorage at a party during that point when I was that age, junior in high school, something like that. Yeah, probably a junior. And this guy had homebrew in his bathtub, which is like a big funny thing now that, like, you know, homebrew, it's in a bathtub, it's terrible or whatever. Or it was, you know, I guess previous to now when people respect it more. Just the general public. But
back
this
when,
was like
back
funny.
When bathtubs had good flavor to them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But it wasn't like homebrew in a bathtub. He had carboys in the bathtub probably for his, I don't know, temperature controllers. Who knows? He probably didn't have a clue what he was doing. I still know the guy. You know, he had bottled it up and it was carbonated and somehow you could open this cap and we're at this party and there's beer that he made. Like that's not possible.
Right.
This is insane.
Yeah. This happens in factories. This doesn't happen in your house. Like, how can you do this?
No, it's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like, I didn't drink per se. I wasn't like a
kid
that drank a lot. I was underage and I was like really young and just at a party and, you know, wow, you can like make beer. Like, seemed like something that would be obviously really neat to find out how this genius did this. Like, this guy's got to be the smartest person on the planet. You know, he made beer.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
And I had one, I think. I mean, I don't even really remember. That was kind of an aha moment. But I remember it was good and it was beer. And my dad's beer was Oli. And I kind of like, I thought, wow, this is actually like better than that. For some, you know, tasted different. Wasn't, I don't know. There was just this thing about Oli. I don't know. That's a whole other story. Yeah. So I kind of, that was in my mind for a long time. And I moved to Colorado after high school to snowboard at Crested Butte, and well, I could go into so many different tangents here, which I'm really good at. But I started homebrewing with a roommate in a guitar player in my band, Karsten Hilpert. We went in on some homebrew stuff. He wanted to do it, and I was like, oh man, like that'd be great. We were broke, and you know, we drank a lot of beer, and we started homebrewing, and you know, it was terrible and awesome and scary because I wasn't 21.
Was your first batch? Did your first batch turn out pretty well?
The first batch was drinkable, I think, maybe because it was exciting. It was a stout too, so it was, you know, it's easy to mask a stout. It's not like we made some fancy beer right off the bat, you know. At that point, I remember for sure thinking that hops were just hops. Like there was hops. It wasn't strained, you know, different varieties of hops. There was hops. Mm-hmm. So the barley made total sense. This part's burned. This part's not. We're going to make this. We get this extract. It's going to make it dark because it's obviously burned and black.
So you were extract, like partial mash kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The sack in the
steeped
grain bag steeped for a while. We probably boiled it. Who knows?
Oh, yeah.
Like, we just probably ruined everything. We probably threw it into the boiling water or something. I don't know. I don't remember at all. But I remember Carson didn't. That's a weird thing to say. But sanitation was not on his top priorities.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So I remember thinking,
well, it's usually not. You know,
even though I didn't know, I remember thinking like, dude, you should. Maybe
all that fuzzy stuff probably should come off first, yeah. Right?
But it was fun, and Carson and I had a blast doing those few brews we did there at our house. And we had a 5-bedroom ranch house we rented for our band, and we were trying to live off the band. Like, they were in college, so they had their money. I had nothing. So we needed like a few little gigs here and there to make enough money to cover my rent, which was the mudroom. I lived in the mudroom because it was so cheap because I didn't have a job and I was trying to live off this crap.
Is that what
band.
You called the first beer, mudroom?
It should have been. Yeah. The second beer, that's a good story. Huge party. Everybody comes to see our band. We're called Necron 99, which is just a killer reference still to this day. I love that. It was from the movie Wizards, animated psychedelic film with partially animated.
Yeah. Really yeah.
Great movie to watch acid or watch acid. Take acid and watch the movie. And Necron 99 was this insane character that was like killing the hippies and was just this, you know, this ridiculous cartoon red bubble that rode on a horse and was absolutely just the weirdest. The hippies would jump up and they were like fairies, but they were real people. And they'd go, hey, like, can't we just have peace and love? And the Necron 99 would just like open fire on him with a laser gun or something. It was just,
which is what you did to your crowds.
It was just ridiculous. We just thought, this is so funny, you know? So Necron 99 is what we call our band, which was the crazy blob that rode a horse and was bad, the bad guy in the movie. Yeah, so we're having a party with our band, Necron's playing, and we were loud and obnoxious. I was the singer. I basically wanted to be Perry Farrell. So I made all my own clothes, and I wore like bangle, you know, piercings, and was just like being just a
Bangles crossover band.
Flying my freak flag thing. A Bangles cross, exactly. So I look in the back of the crowd. This story could go on forever, but our homebrew is in the room, in our band room, and there's probably 50 people. Jock dude at the party uncorks the stopper off of our carboy, picks up the carboy, and drinks out of it. And I'm the singer, so I'm just looking at the crowd and doing my stupid crowd work because I'm a Perry Farrell wannabe, right? And I just see this dude hoist
5 gallons
five
of liquid.
Gallons of beer and take a drink out of it, which is a feat, right?
That is a feat, yeah. Yeah. I mean, to lift it up above your head and not slip, to not drop it onto yourself. Yeah, yeah.
Or cut his leg off or something. Yeah, and I just remember like, oh my God, after that party, that carboy was just sitting there and we dumped it out, but it was like, we had no money, right. No money.
Yeah.
So buying like a kit to, you know.
Yeah, it's $30. Yeah.
And Carson was 21, so he could go. I was too scared to go to the brew store at that point because I was really young. I graduated when I was 17 and I was 17, so I was like, I'm not going to buy the hops. Like, is that legal?
To go buy hops.
Yeah. Just-
Yeah, the hops.
The hops, yeah. To go buy the
that
hops.
That hop stuff. Not doing that.
So that was the beginning.
Yeah. And so by the time you got here, or to, you know, Bellingham, Deming area, for those unaware, Deming is just outside of Bellingham, Washington. How confident were you as a brewer? You know, like, what was your level of expertise at that point?
That's a long jump from that long story that I just told about Colorado. But from Alaska to Colorado, then there's 5 years in between there, because I was 17.
Right.
When I took over the brewery at the North Fork, I was 22. So is my math correct on that?
Sure.
So yeah, the time in between was absolute rabbit home brewing. Like, I worked on craft, you know, I went back and forth between Alaska. I discovered Bellingham because of Mount Baker. I realized that I could get just as hurt in Colorado as I could in Alaska because it was the same temperature. I was tired of snowboarding on ice. I'm ridiculously fanatical about snowboarding. So I was so hurt in Alaska riding too much ice throughout the winter that when I moved to Colorado, it was the same thing. And I'd have like many, 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 many shoulder dislocations and broken ribs. And just I was not on a good path to continue being able to have fun and continue doing
body that. Was going to break eventually.
Yeah, I was I'm reaping the benefits of that like you can't believe right now.
Yeah, it just gets better.
It's going to be great. it's going to be fun.
Oh, God, yeah.
But I discovered Mount Baker, and it snows more than anywhere on Earth here, and it's warm snow, and it's generally not icy, and if it is, you don't go. I mean, it snows so much that I'm just a gigantic snob now. I try to go every single day that it snows, which is a lot. And this year was unbelievable. But when I first came here, I was like, oh my God. Like the snow walls were just, I'd never seen so much snow in my life, you know? And I grew up on the side of a mountain in Alaska where people think there's that much snow.
Right.
But there's a lot of snow, but not like when you go to the top of where Heather Meadows is, like up at Mount Baker, and you go, oh my God, there's 25 feet tall banks. So I showed up here on my way back home from Colorado, and a girlfriend, a girl that I dated, I ran into in Seattle, and she said, you should go visit your friend Dennis in Bellingham. And I was like, Bellingham, where's that, you know? And so I'm just kind of living in my VW bus on my way home to Commercial Fish in Alaska. And I went, he took me to Mount Baker. I showed up at his house. We had a barbecue, and he said, hey, man, like, you need to come check this out. And we went up there, and I just, my head exploded. I couldn't even believe it. I called Alaska, my boat captain, and said, I think I'm going to stay
never
here.
Coming back.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to stay here. So I did. I literally did. I lived in his yard, he and his wife Carrie's yard in my van, and just, like, waited until the snow came again because it was the end of the year. Got a job and kind of started making roots here, which I never expected. I figured I'd do that for a year and then go fishing again, you know, which I sort of did. I mean, that year, they were building the North Fork, I believe. God, this timeline's going to be hard for me in my head to figure out, but that's not true. No, it was before the North Fork at that point. So I got a place at the Lumpy Dumps in Fairhaven. You know what that is?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I lived at the Lumpy Dumps for almost a year, and that's when the switch flipped, and I was like, okay, I'm going to homebrew like crazy. And I got a job in Bellingham, and I just brewed and snowboarded every day, and that's what I did for that year. And that would be 95, 96 winter. That's when I really, really, really started like homebrewing all the time and getting really crazy about it, which was, I was still 18. So I was totally nervous, just not a kid that, you know, I'd go into the brew store. So I'd go in there and be like, you know, where you arch your back and go, okay, hey, you guys, I'm going to need some of the hops. Yeah. And
I am definitely old enough to be doing this. But exactly, you were, that's
just
the thing.
No, like, but I'm probably sweating and blushing at the same time.
But you can buy all the stuff. You just can't put it all together and make beer. It's totally legal for you to buy all the ingredients.
It still feels like you're doing something.
Oh, I know.
Wrong.
That's the best part.
You're like, dude, I know, but I'd go in there and just be like, oh, God. These guys know
so
I probably
nervous.
Shouldn't
yeah,
be doing
these
this.
Guys know I'm
and
a
they
poser.
Know so much more than I do. So I'm just like, kind of, you know, just, I just remember. I definitely remember going and just like psyching myself out, like in the car, like I'm not even going to go in with the list. I'm just going to know what I need. I need the hops and I need the, I'm going to need some barley and I'm going to, you know, like, I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. Yeah. So from there I brewed a ton at the Lumpy Dumps in Fairhaven, these crazy little strange cabins in Fairhaven. And then I left and went on a crab boat in Alaska and made a ton of money, throughout a summer tendering and working on the Viking Queen, an Icicle Seafoods company boat, made a lot of money. Bluffed my way into that job by just, it's a neat thing. I wrote Viking ancestry on my resume for no reason. It was my dad's idea. And I wrote that I had 20 years of fishing experience because I'd turned 20 years old. And they hired me because they thought I had 20 years of fishing experience and that I must have known somebody to have an inn for a boat named the Viking Queen.
Mm-hmm.
None of that was true. I had 20 years of experience because I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
Or 19 or whatever.
Grew up in a fishing family.
However many years I wrote was how old I was. I think it was 19. Yeah. So I went and did that, made a whole bunch of money for a kid that age and like took 2 years off basically of working. And then I just brewed and baked. And then that's kind of the whole segue into my experience at the North Fork is because I got so obsessed with yeast.
I was just telling somebody how not only were you came up with the yeast, not with the yeast, but with the crust, the pizza crust that is being used out there now.
Yeah, I didn't come up with it. I redesigned it. Knut Christensen, who started the kitchen, is like my cooking hero.
Yeah, he's a madman.
He's a total madman. He's awesome. And he just is just amazing, his vision of how he puts things together in a kitchen and stuff like that. And he hired me there. Knut hired me. I worked in the kitchen for a year and a half. When I first got there, you know, after I got comfortable and became really good friends with Knut, I was kind of like, well, you know, the pizza doughs could, you know, we could work on it. And he's just like, I don't know anything about baking. You know, his whole expertise is in a different direction. He was like, if you got any ideas. And I'm like, I just took 2 years off and just baked and made beer. So I've got a lot of ideas. Yeah, there was no oil in the dough and there was no beer in the dough. So I redesigned it and we called it dough science. And I would have stacks of, I would do tiny, small batches of dough and proof them and age them to the point where we were ready to toss. And like we would make pies and send them upstairs to Sandy and Vicky, the owners. And they would like give the thumbs up or thumbs down as they were getting to what they wanted it to be, which I, from talking to them, knew where they were thinking. Even though they weren't disappointed with what it was per se, it was like it could be better. So I didn't make the dough. I designed it from where it was to where it is now.
Right, right.
And we've never changed it since then.
Well, it's delicious.
Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us about how you got started in the brewery there and how you got involved with that. Because, I mean, you're just a one-man show.
I made it very clear to Sandy that I would want to do that. And we started to kind of get to know each other a little bit. Because Sandy was, always been just beer side and Vicky's the whole rest of the business. I just wasn't going to stay in the kitchen or anything. And eventually he asked me, my friend Jason was brewing there. He had a few different brewers before I was there, my friend Arlo and my friend Jason Custis. Jason said he was going to leave to go pursue a different job in California working at Bonterra Vineyards. Sandy knew that. I mean, I had made it very, I really, really want to do this. And he offered it to me and I was just like, yeah. I mean, it was freaky because he had a lot of health issues going on with his back and all these certain things that he was doing at that point. And they were bad. So basically Jason trained me. Not basically, Jason did train me. We did three brews together.
Yeah.
Sandy was laid up and like around but not even able to hang out.
Yeah, I remember him getting the surgery and just disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For a long time he was like in his mom's van out because he couldn't get up and down the stairs, so he was just outside.
Right.
So we would talk by, I could just like talk through the window of the van. Very strange to think about now because it's just absolutely bizarre. But so I was kind of terrified just taking over without Sandy training me.
Sure.
Knowing that it's his ridiculously weird system that the North Fork is and still is. And Jason training me, who'd really brewed there for about 8 months. So he kind of had a crash course and so did I because Jason trained me. Mm-hmm. But Jason's very smart and was absolutely great brewer and did what needed to be done. But getting trained that fast and then being just like, okay, later. Mm-hmm. And then there's no Sandy to fall back on.
Right.
And no one to help me whatsoever.
Yeah.
Was really scary.
So you've been there now for 17 years, which is insane. Just kind of touch on what you're doing now. You know, it's my opinion, and I know this opinion is shared, that you're kind of flying under the radar. Less so now, which is good, but you quietly have one of the best sour programs going on. I know just from knowing you that you've put a tremendous, you know, it didn't just happen overnight. You know, you've done your homework, you read everything, you listen to everybody, and you're making these amazing beers. And I know that it was also an uphill battle to be able to do that. Just talk a bit about, you know, going from brewing the more English style standard beers into branching out and doing crazy beers that you're doing now. What was your thought process behind that? What was the and not necessarily what's your whole creative process for it, but how, when you think of a beer, like what flashes in your brain to what's in the glass, how does that work for you?
Well, thank you
for sure
for that setup. But I don't think about it from the beginning really at all. Because they're going to be blends, I try to come up with the most complicated base beers in the barrels. So I've, I think 13 barrels now, which is very small, but.
For a 3.5 barrel
system, I have a lot of leeway to make really complicated blending stock, right?
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to worry about distribution, which is nice.
And I don't have to worry about distribution, right? So that sounded like I'm just saying, throw it whatever together. That's not at all the case. I'm trying to make beers with a lot of body and a really thin body and complexity that spans as far as I can with that amount of barrels. So 13 barrels. So I want this one on this side to be just absolutely rich and sour as you can't even believe, all the way down to like thin and maybe hardly even tart and all sorts of different characteristics coming from all the different bacteria and wild yeast and even, you know, lab cultured yeast, Belgian style yeast, English style yeast, whatever different barrel. And I have barrels that aren't sour that I use from blending stock. And that's the goal. So the process of making the weird sour beers, if that's what you're talking about, just the mm-hmm. sour program, because right? I've got quite a lot of Brett beers that I've been doing too.
Yeah.
That a lot of people consider
it. It was
weird.
Meant to cover everything outside of the, you know, IPA, you know.
Yeah. The Brett beers and the stuff like that, that I know you enjoy, the Saison and stuff like that. That's those styles are fun to play with, where you're designing the beer so much just to be that finished product. From, you know, designing the grist to fermentation and finished beer going out the door. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the blending sour, the really weird stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just
trying
to
know what's going to happen, you know.
No. Yeah. And I do a lot of spontaneous beer too. And you have you guide it in that direction. Mm-hmm. You're giving it the best possible chance to become what you want it to be down the road. Mm-hmm. But you can't really expect anything other than protein and body and all that stuff. But you're not expecting a finished beer from that exact, like, brew, right? You're expecting something that's going to blend and work with the rest of what you're
doing. Pair nicely with something else.
Yeah.
I have always been of the opinion that blending is something that's often overlooked by smaller breweries, but blending is when the fun part starts.
It's the funnest thing ever.
Yeah.
You're trying to come up with nice, delicate, complex lactic flavors and stuff, you know, from different organisms that take time. I think people are making one beer and not embracing the blending idea, or maybe they don't have enough space, or maybe they don't have enough time or patience. The kettle souring thing has really screwed everything up, because it's too easy for people to make these one-dimensional beers that they just blow out the door.
Yeah.
It's sour for sour sake is not good. What do you think about that?
I agree. Yeah, I think there's a lot of mediocre beer out there, but there's always been a lot of mediocre beer out there.
I'm talking specifically in the weird beers, because they sell because this has lactobacillus or this has Brettanomyces or whatever. And it's Pediococcus. Oh, well, Pedio, in my experience, all of my beers have Pedio in them now that are in the barrel program, except for the barrels that are just dedicated to Brett. You can't just throw a beer in there and go, oh, it's good now. It takes forever to pay attention to that. And I've got a lot of beer that gets sick now, that gets, you know, basically the whole barrel turns to jelly. Mm-hmm. And I've read things where it says that it takes 6 weeks for the sickness to go away. I have strains now that take 6 months to turn back into beer. You can pull samples and it's goo. It's solid goo.
Yeah, that's so nuts
to think about. It's so nuts. I love feeding it to people
before
they
told
don't
me,
know.
Before you showed me that, it was like, I have never experienced this before in my life.
And I told you.
Yeah.
I've given it to people when they didn't know what was going to happen. And it's a fun experience to watch somebody's face when they drink sick beer that...
should take their picture and put it on like, bottle labels and stuff.
Aaron Gibbs from Chuckin' It. That was the best. That was the pinnacle. He spit it out and it was drooling down his chin.
Yeah. Yeah, I
love you, Aaron.
I hear that. I hear that a lot, you know, and I agree with you. I think a lot of people make the hot beers, you know, the sellers, the big sellers, and just put out an approximation of those, of what those beers can be, and make money. I think it's doing a disservice overall, because to take the time to do it right, and not every brewer has that luxury, but my argument would be, if you don't have that luxury, then don't do it. Yeah, concentrate on something else. Is there anything else you'd like to add on your North Fork experience to date?
Oh, you know, the whole thing is bizarre. I mean, I remember going in there before they opened in my VW bus that I lived in, that I was talking about before when I was a home brewer. And I thought that the whoever owned the North Fork was just some insane family or person that homebrewed like me, but made a sign for their house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they put up the sign way before they opened.
Right, yeah.
And it's like brewery, pizzeria.
Yeah, beer shrine.
Beer shrine. Yeah. I don't know if Wedding Chapel was on there and all that. But
no, I don't think it was. I remember on the first being sign, like, yeah.
What the fuck is... Like, just pulling my van over and,
yeah,
like, looking in the windows, and it was, like, this tiny little brewery, and I'm like, this is some...
Yeah.
I should make a sign for my house. You know what I mean? Like, and then when they opened, I was like, oh, God, this is just so cool. This is, yeah, like, the coolest thing
it's
ever.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. And it was just like, what is happening? And it was just so weird.
Yeah.
In the beginning, you know? So, I don't know. I guess in retrospect... At this point, it's just been a career,
yeah,
of strangeness. Well,
half your life.
I mean,
at this point, right?
We had four beers on tap, five. Oh yeah, this is fun. This is a funny thing. If you've ever been to the North Fork, when I first started like working in the kitchen, we had American wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, you know now,
yeah,
how strange this would be to walk in there and see any of these. What was it called? Brown. It was called something brown. God.
Yeah, just the standard.
Sandy didn't like names, like, right, like cutesy names.
Yeah.
So it was American wheat. Oh, mild brown. American wheat, mild brown.
Yeah.
ESB, dry stout. Okay, so these aren't all on at the same time, but this would be all the, basically the, yeah, recipes,
the whole catalog,
that I used. The whole catalog.
Yeah.
And so there would have been four on at a time, plus the cool thing, barley wine year round. That's a unique thing about the North Fork, is we've never not had barley wine on for the entire life of the North Fork.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. Do you remember Boundary used to have the Old Bounder on all the time, but you had to ask for it?
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I thought Old Bounder has always been kind of
seasonal. We used to have it on year round. Yeah. I mean, those were the days when Boundary closed at 10 o'clock on a Friday night.
Really?
It was great because Howard and I could always just sample it and see where it was at any point in time. You know,
actually on tap?
On tap. You just had to know to ask for it. It didn't have a tap handle, but you just had
like
to know.
Just like a keg in the...
Yeah, we always had a keg on.
It's not like you had a serving tank.
No, we couldn't tie up a serving tank that long.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in those days, we couldn't, you know, tie it up. So it was all kegged. But yeah, it was on year round. And then once the word really got out and Boundary got more popular and beer got more popular, we eventually had to take it off. But
man, I don't remember that.
Yeah. So we took it off before I even left.
You were one of my first like ins in Boundary, because I wanted to do the Belgian thing. I mean, we've had this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't talk Ed into it.
I was like,
it's still an uphill battle.
I guess. I was asked Robert. It was probably Robert when he was on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, I'm going to make a Belgian beer at the North Fork. You know, this would be like 2001 or something. And they said, well, no, I asked Skip. I asked Skip Madsen.
Oh yeah.
Hey man, I'm gonna make this. Like, you have an experience with the Abbey yeast or whatever. At that point, I probably thought there was two strains that I could. There probably was just a few.
Probably
available.
Just a few strains, yeah.
And
certainly not like saison strain, you know.
Yeah, no, yeah, way.
None of that.
Never
stuff.
Even heard the word like saison.
A couple
in
Belgian strains, yeah.
But he was like, you know, Skip, just out mellow. Yeah, you're going to need to talk to Dave about that. And then that's how we met.
Yeah, right.
I went in there and was like, hey, man.
Yeah.
I want to make a double. And you were like, oh, really? No way. And then we talked about that.
Yeah.
That's how we met.
Yeah. I do remember you coming back there. I remember that.
And you were like, get the fuck out of here.
I was not.
You don't know anything about doubles.
So let's talk about fun stuff. You brought a beer.
I brought a couple beers.
Beer's not allowed here.
Yeah.
Dave?
Yes.
I, in anticipating the fact that you would probably ask me like my gateway beer mm-hmm. or something like that, mm-hmm. I brought one, which I bet you can't.
I didn't even think that it's so far. I'll give you a hint. Okay. You have to guess.
All right.
At least a couple times.
Okay. So this is the beer.
This is kind of my, I saw it today at a store and it blew my mind because I thought, you know, I got a six pack of Melvin Pale Ale to bring over here.
And so you're talking gateway beer, like one of the, not, probably not.
Yeah, literally I got that beer at the Melvin uh-huh. and next to it was a 22 or whatever volume of this beer. It's a strange volume. And I was like, that is so weird that I'm going to go talk to Dave. And I thought right then, if he asked me what my gateway beer is, I'm going to buy this just to bring it to him. It's not going to be good.
Is it Sierra Nevada Pale?
No.
No,
that's
it's not.
But that's the standard. I know that's the standard, and it's not mine.
Okay.
I mean, let's talk about that. What was your gateway beer?
My gateway beer was Michelob Classic Dark.
What?
Yeah. Dude. CDs before there were CDs.
Weinhardt's Dark, can I get a high five?
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah, Weinhardt's didn't exist where I was in Texas.
Oh, right, because that was Portland.
Yeah, so I remember Michelob Classic Darks. Like, that was where I realized, oh, beer can have flavor, and they don't make it anymore, so I would love to either A, have the recipe, or two, you know, be able to try it again. But
I think it was probably mostly caramel color.
I think it was probably
caramel,
I mean,
flavoring,
you know,
or whatever.
The first beer that I really took seriously, I mean, that was just the beer that was like, oh, this is a good beer. But the beer that right as I was turning 21 was super popular in Austin was Shiner Bock.
We used to snowboard every day after school, and I, you know, I'm from Chugiak, which is like 30 minutes to 40 minutes north of Anchorage. My buddy Brandon DeLiva had an apartment that he rented in high school. We would snowboard after school and then stay at Brandon's house all the time. All the time.
Sure.
Junior, senior year. And it was Boone's Farm almost every day because we had to get somebody to buy it for us.
Yeah, it was right? $3.
And it was so cheap.
Oh, yeah.
And all the girls, the girls that would come over would be stoked. We'd have like a fridge stocked full of Boone's Farm wine. And no, but I was into, and this leads us to our segue where we're going to try this beer, right?
Yeah.
I'm an old radio guy. See how good that was?
Yeah.
What a segue.
Oh, man.
This Dude, was my I'm gonna super, edit that this out. Was my super gateway because nobody.
So this is not Weinhardt's.
This is not Weinhardt's.
Okay.
Weinhardt's Dark was one of my
so
gateways.
Give me the year.
This is my actual gateway.
Give me the year that. About that this
93.
Was. Oh, 93. Okay. And in Anchorage, I don't know what was available then, but I'm guessing big.
Well, this wasn't my first beer because I grew up with Ole. This is my gateway to like before the guy with the homebrew and all that when I went, there's like, this isn't just a world of just this terrible shit that my dad drinks.
Let's see. I was in Alaska in 94. Yeah, I was there in 94 and 95, and the selection that I remember is like Thomas Kemper Blueberry Lager, Pete's Wicked Ale.
Pete's was definitely up there with my gateways.
Varsteiner, I remember that. Like,
man,
is changing our lives.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a revelation.
It'd be fun to get it fresh, but yeah. I like it now. Still.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
We got a keg of it at a North Fork party.
Nice.
Like 2 years ago.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it could be so many things.
It could. You're never going to guess, so I'm going to pull it out.
All right, I'll shriek like a little girl.
You're going to be like, I don't want to drink that.
Oh, not at all what I was expecting.
That's what I thought.
But I mean, yeah, I like that beer. I haven't had it for
ever. Drank this for years.
And we're never going to reveal what it is. We're just going to drink it and never say
it,
the
it
name of it.
It tasted like soy sauce and just garbage. But it was like the most amazing thing.
Nice. And so is that
I wish I could remember. I don't remember who I had it with. It was probably my girlfriend my junior year.
Yeah.
But she drank Lucky Lager. That was her thing, was Lucky.
Yeah.
But I had this and I was like, no one else will want this.
Right.
And that was my thing. I was like, I really enjoy this whole, I got some books. I started reading about beer, British beers and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, like there's this whole thing out there.
Yeah.
But not here.
Right.
It's obviously in other places in the world other than Alaska. And this is from Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was going to say, that's not British.
Oh
yeah.
My God. This is like Australian beer?
Yeah. Wow, so to put people out of their misery, the beer is?
Sheaf Stout.
Yeah.
It was my...
And that's not a milk stout. It's just a gateway. Sweet stout, right? It's not a milk stout?
It's a garbage stout, actually, I think they call it. No, it's... I don't know what it is, but it's a sort of a sweet, weird...
I remember it being
It's
sweet.
Not a milk stout. It's not like it has lactose.
Yeah, it's not lactic or lactose.
You ready, Dave?
I am ready.
We're gonna crack a sheaf here.
All right. Man, I haven't had this in forever.
Oh, I didn't even need to open that like that. It's a twisty. Super. You can tell by the mold on top of it.
It's a big seller.
Oh, it's funny.
Nice.
That old brown and yellow label, though, yeah. It always gets me.
Sweet. Cheers.
Ooh, it smells right. Pretty good.
Yeah, it smells good. A little caramely.
Oh, it just takes me back. No, it's probably better than it ever was. Tastes fine to me. Kind of chocolatey.
Yeah, it's a lot thinner than I thought it would be.
I
don't remember it being that thin.
I'm shocked. I can hardly talk right now. So it's so much thinner and like
I am stupefied.
And better than I expected.
Yeah, it's good.
It's a little chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
It actually finished fairly dry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This was like the thickest, craziest.
It's probably
thing.
Been sitting in bottling conditioning for a long time.
It's not bottle conditioned. There's no
well,
way.
I mean, but it is now.
Yeah, it is now. It's,
that's what
it's
I'm
been
saying.
Breaking
it's,
down.
It's a little. It's
three.
A little drier than it was when it went into the bottle.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is enjoyable. I don't remember it being as roasty as it is. Like I'm getting kind of some roasted barley
thick,
in there. Yeah.
But that could also be that I grew up on Oli.
No, I remember it being thick too. It's not I how I remember it. This is more like Guinness-y than I get that roastedness
roastiness. Well, the dryness that Guinness finishes with is more intense than this, but this is,
and I don't remember it being as, I mean, you can see it's got the brownish head on there, so it's definitely got roasted barley in there, which you can taste. I don't remember there being that much of that in this.
I'm
definitely
shocked.
Can't see through it.
I'm actually totally
There's actually
shocked.
Sun outside.
I thought
outside,
this would be really funny and we might just set it aside and laugh, but I'm going to finish it. It's good.
I'm going to drink it. Yeah. Right. Well, that answered that question. What was the first beer you ever had but is this the beer that flipped the switch, or would you say that your buddy's homebrew is? Like, what was the beer where you
I
were like...
I think the homebrew was the...
Yeah,
was
like,
the,
I need to be able to know how to do this.
Like,
yeah.
I had a sheaf stout with... I would think it was that girl, and then I kind of went, oh my God, you can make beer. And then this would be why I thought it was possible. Cause who would care to make the crappy beer that you had, like that I grew up with my dad drinking, which is nostalgic to think about the beers the Olies and stuff that I drank with my dad.
Okay. I grew up with Lone Star and Pearl and Coors.
Yeah. I have a picture of myself holding a Prinzbrow beer, which I bet you've never heard of.
I haven't.
It's the only brewery ever in Alaska before the 80s when the microbrew revolution happened. It was called Prinzbrow, Alaska's beer. If you look behind my wood stove at my house, there's a wood cutting that says Prinzbrow, Alaska's beer on it. It was my grandpa's. And I have a picture of me holding a can of it. And I'm like maybe two or three. It's crazy. It's a cool
that
picture.
Is. Yeah, I'm going to make sure and check that out next time I'm out there.
And I'm next to a garbage can and I think it's empty and my dad probably just asked me to throw it away.
And, well, who knew, you know?
But it's one of those cute pictures of a
and
kid.
And who knew what it would mean
a little
to
tiny
you,
kid holding a beer, can of beer, which I have a bunch of friends that have pictures like that. They go, oh, yeah, I have a picture like that with my dad.
Yeah.
Or my dad took of me holding one of his
beer. Yeah, back when it was okay to hand
cans.
Your kid a beer. And it wouldn't be on Instagram, and like you wouldn't be arrested.
About that.
Oh, well, I grew up in Texas. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah, moose hunting with my dad. He forgot the Mountain Dew every year.
Like, no, you're better off for it.
Yeah, he'd have a, you know, a pack for like a meat pack with the metal rails and everything on your back, just stuffed full of all of our gear. I'm too small to.
Right.
Not really too small, but I have my little backpack. What are they called? I've got a little kid backpack.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get to set up camp and I'd be like, where's the Mountain Dew? And it would just be like all Oli. Mm-hmm. My dad would go, I'm not going to carry Mountain Dew into the woods.
Like, come on. That shit's heavy.
Like Yeah,
if I'm going to carry sugar water, it's going to be beer.
And he'd say, you can have some Oli or you can go filter. You can go down there and get some water and we'll boil it and we'll, you know.
And this is so practically water. So we would boil
water and do the whole thing and work. Yeah. Set up our camp, but it would be like, no, there's no Mountain Dew. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to walk that far. You're going to have to man up and
drink some Oli. You 3-year-old little wimp.
My dad. Sorry, Dad. If he ever listens to this.
Probably not, unless you send it to him. Hopefully somebody hears this.
He knows this story very well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, he was there. He was the one that made that decision. So I'm just going to kind of do some rapid fire questions here, and that doesn't mean that you need to answer them quickly. And what's your favorite beer to brew? Like, is there a style that you like, or is that even a fair question?
That's a great question. I always kind of, as far as brewing now by myself, what I get excited about is like really complicated
nerd beers.
Yeah. Unlike what we were talking about before, where I'm brewing all these things to meet blending stock for sours and stuff.
Yeah.
I like brewing things specifically like saisons and stuff like that are the funnest. See if I can just nail what I'm trying to nail. Yeah, the triple I have on right now, I'm really proud of. It exceeded my expectations of what
expectations.
Yeah, I'm super duper excited about it.
I will make it out next week.
My friend John Andrews and I brewed it together. He's a good friend and he just like bothered me for fucking years about brewing Belgian beers, like traditional Belgian styles, like doubles and triples. And like when I first met you, I mean, literally that's what I wanted to do. And that went on the back burner after we met, because I experimented with a bunch of the Abbey yeast and I didn't have good results with the final product, but it probably more stemmed from the fact that I didn't understand how to build the grist and how to, you know, put together the mash that would make that beer work.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. It's and almost counterintuitive. I certainly wasn't going
to scale it up to a 100 gallons from being a 5-gallon brewer. I didn't know that, like, I'm not going to waste this amount of money for Sandy and Vicky.
Yeah. In those days, there weren't a lot of books about like how to make Belgian beer. So you're like, oh wait, Pilsner malt? It's almost all Pilsner malt.
And using sugar was kind of was frowned upon.
Anathema.
Yeah. And like now you're like, you know, you just need to know what sugar and how to use it and where it goes.
You can use table sugar. I mean, really, like candy sugar, at least the rock sugar that you get.
I used straight sucrose for the triple.
It's all just straight sucrose.
No, I did it. I used two different Belgian yeast strains that I was really excited by. I talked to Robert Arzu about these strains that he was kind of excited. And he hooked me up with some stuff just to sample. And I grew them up and tried different things with them. And then I finally ended up with a blend of those yeasts. And then finished the whole thing with Brett Brooks. And did a sugar regimen at the end that just turned out just killer. And John and I, he's wanted these traditional Belgian styles for a long time. He's gave me a lot of crap about it. Just joking with me, you know. But the double ended up so good and it sold great that we did the triple and now we're going to do a quad. Nice. And I named him Brother Crazy John after him giving me shit.
Oh, yeah. I think I know John. He's in there a lot.
Yeah. He's a local guy. He lives in Ferndale, but he comes out and has a beer.
Right. Yeah.
Quite often and just, you know, gives me crap. And yeah, we're doing this Belgian series, but it's working out. And that right there, like your question, that is my favorite thing to do is to I'm going to make a triple and I go out and get a bunch of triples. I try them and I think about what I want out of this and that. And then just, you know, put together a grain bill and really think about like how I want, what am I going to hit here? And that one is one that I'm like really proud of right now.
Nice.
it wasn't, it's not super complicated, but it's complicated in that whatever else I did wouldn't work.
It's complicated in the fact that it's so simple.
Triples, yeah, and you kind of got to realize that you need to be, but you don't have to get crazy to make a crazy beer.
No.
It's a really intense, interesting beer.
That's what I'm saying. Like it was a revelation. Like, oh, I want to make a crazy, complicated tasting triple. What goes into that? Oh, Pilsner malt and Saaz hops. Okay.
Yeah, totally. I used Pilsner malt and Tettnang hops, and because I used Brett, it finished at one Plato. So getting a triple down that low, I used a bunch of flaked wheat to boost the mouthfeel towards the end. And it's got like the mouthfeel, and it's dry. It's so fucking dry. I mean, it's like one Play-Doh.
Yeah.
But it finishes with a really nice mouthfeel where you don't feel like it's too thin.
Good. What did you mash at?
Do
you
remember? I wish I would have.
Yeah, yeah, that's all right. Who knew we were going to be bringing this up? Dorking out.
I mashed at 150.
Okay. So pretty high. So yeah. So especially with Pilsner malt and stuff, you'd get a lot residual. What's your favorite beer to drink? Like it could be a style. It could be a specific thing.
Pale ales.
Pale ales. Me too. Cheers to that as we Cheers drink the Sheaf Stout.
That's an easy question.
You know, I had...
Saisons too, if they're not...
Yeah. I'd like to do some Saisons with you. That would be fun.
Real Saisons are just a dry beer like that that's mm-hmm. balanced and nice.
Yeah.
It's one thing I hate is the word... Everybody uses the word balance too much, I think, in beer.
And balance doesn't necessarily mean there's an equal amount of hops and grains, or at least flavor-wise. You know, it shouldn't just be overpoweringly dumb.
Yeah, I'm talking sweetness to bitterness.
Yeah.
I like that to be balanced. And then I and prefer hops everything can else to be out of balance.
Sweetness, you know.
I want to taste the malt and then taste the, like a really nice hop character. Mm-hmm. Like that Melvin that we just had earlier, that the Melvin Pale Ale, the MPA, mm-hmm. that's like their regular IPA is too strong. I have, mm-hmm. you know, it's fun to have one.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I can't.
Yeah, that's an IPA. I mean, it was delicious. But when I think Pale Ale, I think more Sierra Nevada, you know, or even Stone Pale Ale was always nice.
Yeah. Firestone
Pale mm-hmm. Ales? Oh, Firestone. Man, they're so good.
Date Codes. I'm a big Date Code crazy person right now because I live out in the county.
Mm-hmm.
They sit there. It sounds snobby too. Like well, I feel like I sound snobby right now.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Well, it's like, would you buy a piece of meat that had been sitting there for 3 weeks? You know, it's going to be funky.
I dumped out a Firestone Union Jack and that's one of my favorite IPAs. I love that. If I want an IPA, a big, strong, crazy IPA,
yeah,
I want it to be hoppy and intense and overbalanced and bitter and all that. And just for, you know, I usually only want one. Then I'll go back to the pale ale, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's so bad. This Firestone I had, I mean, I can't. It's been my thing lately. There's a store out in the county that I just saw Union Jack that was 2 years old.
Yeah,
that beer might be fine, but it's not Union Jack IPA.
So what's your guilty pleasure?
Guilty pleasure beer?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a cider fan, so cider is a guilty pleasure, I guess, is a beer nerd when I hang out with people and I'll roll up some cider. It's like, what are you doing? But that's not the question.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of the question. Be, I mean, like, it could be anything. Like Chris's answer was gin and tonics. So
cider for sure. I love cider. Okay, yeah. I'm a big cider fan. I make cider. I love cider.
Yeah, I have yet to fall in love with cider. I've tried so many's. I've made it.
I like everything dry. I mean, it's funny that we're having the Sheaf Stout because I remember it being so heavy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And no, I remember this being way heavier. I think that
was like
the heavier.
Gateway was heavy was, man, it was like in my head, it was good because I didn't understand what was good back in the day. But now it's all about dry for mm-hmm. everything. I don't like hardly anything that isn't dry. I mean, I judge barley wine contests
mm-hmm.
and that's the opposite of dry, right? And it's supposed to be. But I would never order a barley wine unless I knew it was going to be great,
mm-hmm.
and I'd have one, and that's that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just like dry. That's
yeah.
Like saisons and stuff like
me
that.
Me too. I mean, my mash temperatures, just to completely dork out, like they rarely go above 147 or 8.
Yeah.
Unless I really need that body, you know. But even then, I'll substitute it with grain that gives body.
Yeah.
You know.
Me too. Like we were just talking about the triple and I said 150.
Yeah.
That's like, because of the rest of the grist, it's going to be building body into it. But I wanted the fermentability to be maximum, and it's going to be, or I mean, fermentability be just a little bit higher than the 147, 148, mm-hmm. and with all the Brett that's going on in there, just to leave something behind. Yeah. And it worked.
All right, so these are rapid fire.
Nope.
What is your favorite grain to brew with?
Oh, for Christ's sake. I know. You know not to try to rapid fire me.
I know. There's one. What is
Pilsner
it?
Pilsner malt.
Okay, yeah. What's your favorite hop?
If I had to pick a desert island hop, it'd probably be Cascade. I don't know.
Cascade. Yeah, yeah.
Styrian Golding I used to get a lot, and it was such an interesting thing, but now there's so many more interesting hops. I'd probably just go back to like a Cascade or a Centennial. Or
mm-hmm.
I really like Columbus right now.
Yeah,
but
super earthy.
Favorite hop? I don't have any exotic ones that I.
Yeah, I know it's hard.
I think about that question, if you could only have one hop,
right?
Right. Mm-hmm. But if it was just like favorite hop right now, maybe Columbus.
Mm.
But it wouldn't be one that I'd want to have only
forever. Columbus. Yeah.
If it was an only hop, it'd be Cascade, or like a Golding derivative, or just an East Kent Golding.
Yeah. I like the noble hops. I like the spicy hops, like the Saws and stuff like that.
What would your one hop be?
I would say you couldn't really use it. I mean, this is getting specific, but, you know, you couldn't use it because of the low alphas in an IPA or something. But, you know, like a Saws type derivative, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, my Tetanangs,
uh-huh.
guess what they just came in at?
Everything's jumping.
Alpha.
What? I don't know.
Guess.
Is it high or low? Or
guess.
8.
1.9. Yeah, that's why I wanted you to guess, because that's your reaction. Yeah. I've got 33 pounds of 1.9 alpha.
Oh, man. Dry hopping. Wow. That's crazy. Yeah,
so like all the hefe and the wit, everything that I use a lot, I make a lot, is 1.9. So I just do a bittering with Magnum and German Magnum and use that as the flavoring component, which is not doing that much anyway, but it's like so stupid. Like hop farmers, the purveyors should say, hey, guess what? You're contracted for this hop. 1.9? I mean, mm-hmm. it came in, I'm like, what are you?
Yeah, what is happening here?
Dude.
Yeah.
They're five, Tetanang's 5 or 6 alpha always.
Yeah.
1.9. That happened with me with Styrians too.
Oh.
Yeah. Huh. Cardwell, Brian at Chuckanut, uh-huh. was like, no way. He was so excited. He's like, we'll take it all. We'll trade you with the Styrians, because they came in at 1.3 or something. And he likes the polyphenol load that you can add just a ton of hops and not get any bittering component and get all the oils out of it.
So yeast.
Was that a quick enough answer?
Yeah,
that was
quick enough. Yeah. Doesn't matter. What's your favorite yeast to use?
Well, 1968 is like my buddy, because it's our house strain.
Yeah.
It's been a great workhorse. Yeah. Sandy got that yeast strain going on for so long, and it's a great, really cool British yeast. It's versatile. You can do a lot of
good flavor,
ferment it cold and keep the esters down, and you can drive esters crazy, letting it warm up. Free rise fermentation like we have without cooling capacity is, you know, it's ultimate for that. On the other side, the Y yeast, Brettanomyces bruxellensis strain is, I've gotten to be pretty good friends with lately too.
Nice.
Yeasts are like buddies, you know?
Oh yeah. No, well they are. I mean, because you have to get to know them and, you know, they become your friends. Like, I know exactly what you're going to do in this situation.
They're super tricky to figure out.
You're going
to
barf all over my beer.
Exactly.
But that's good. That's what I want you to do.
You know who's not my friend anymore? 3944, the Belgian wit strain.
Oh.
Man, we're not buddies.
Huh. I've had, you know, when Chris and I were working on stuff, we were originally really big on the Ardennes strain. And it turned on us at some point. I was like, okay, this is not us. This is this strain. And I haven't tried it in about a year, but I want to brew another beer with it.
That's my favorite Belgian yeast
strain. It's my favorite Belgian yeast strain too.
I asked you, like, Dave, yeah, what do you think? And you remember I got you a couple smack packs back when Y Yeast used to do that.
Yeah.
And you brewed beers for me and grew the yeast up.
Yeah.
And I used that in to brew a whole 100-gallon batch.
I love that strain.
And that became my favorite Belgian strain.
Yep. It changed for a while. I'm very excited to try it again and see what happens. But when Chris and I were brewing a lot of beers and trying stuff like fermenting low, fermenting high, fermenting in the middle, it just was not working. But
I'm curious if that's the
3522.
That yeast strain rules. Yeah. You told me. I mean, I went with you on that one, and I did a few test batches by just fermenting wort out that you gave me that grown up pitch.
Yeah,
and that's what I made the Brother Crazy John double with.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So recently,
that was probably a year and a half ago.
Okay. Well, yeah, that was.
Yeah. No, it was probably 2 years ago.
So let's talk about the brewing industry. You know, things have changed quite a bit. Where do you see it in 5 years, in 10 years? Do you see any trends that you think are going to happen? I mean, it seems like things are turning around so fast that it's really hard to say, but I mean, you're more plugged into it than I am.
Beer-wise or business-wise?
Either.
Both.
Yeah, both.
Business-wise, I think it's going to... I think it's already peaked, and I think shit is going to slide back hill for a while.
There's going to be a shakedown happening very soon.
The shakedown is going to be different, I think, than...
previous ones?
Maybe not you, because you're plugged into what's going on, but I think it's going to... Yeah, different. Oh, certainly different than previous ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but similar to previous ones. The one that happened in the 90s was because of quality.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is going to be quality and oversaturation and... No, I guess it's the same. It's the same thing either way you try to phrase it. I think brewers have the resources and the availability of knowledge at this point to make good. Anybody can figure it out and make good beer.
Mm-hmm.
And there probably is going to be a lot of good beer out there that just doesn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah. Well, I think the general competence level is much higher than it was after the first shakedown. I see the shakedown being more... for people that have really reached out distribution-wise and are concentrating on distribution rather than in-house sales.
Growing too fast.
Growing too fast too soon. Excited. And, I mean, it's so cutthroat for shelf space. And at some point, it's going to reach a point where it's like, well, okay, your beer's not good and it's not selling, so... you're done. You know, like, we're not going to carry you anymore, you know. And there's going to be some casualties. There's going to be some amazing breweries that go away because of either poor business decisions or distributor decisions, or, you know, they're that brewery that
we were talking about Orchard Street earlier. That was a weird time for beer. That was the first shakeout, really, or maybe the end of it. But they, you know, they overextended themselves with a shitty distributor deal. And it was unfortunate because they made really cool beer, and it can happen real easily with a brewery where you go, what the hell?
All right, let's wrap this up. I'm ripping this off from the Dinner Party Download, which is one of my favorite podcasts. Tell us something that the general public wouldn't know about you. And this could be anything from your worst brew day to an odd brewing habit that you have, a fact about your brewery, a quirk of your system, or something personal, or whatever you feel like.
Hmm. Wow. I thought of one. Okay. I have a lot of experiences with bears. Bears in my childhood and my growing up.
Yeah.
How about that, Dave?
Yeah,
that's good. Is that an all right answer?
I've got bear experiences.
Yeah, I have a few serious near-death experiences that would be maybe I was thinking of that people wouldn't, like fishing stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. But bears, dude. I have my dad, my whole child, like my childhood, my like after I left home, my dad was always like, man, you before you get to where you don't remember the details of those, like you're, for some reason, bears are so attracted to me. Like,
did you write anything down? I mean, do you?
No, but I've recorded some stuff.
Oh, like, good.
I'm terrible at writing, but I need maybe a ghostwriter or whatever. How somebody to like write my ghost. You want to do it?
I'll do it.
Really?
Totally.
Oh, I'd love that.
100%.
There was the Alaska Bear Tales. Have you ever seen
those? Oh, yeah. I've read books? Both of them. There's like really? Two or three of them. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And my dad gave me those books because he was like, this is just, I mean, it's kind of weird. I have pictures of like me with bears that you wouldn't even believe. But yeah. I had a.
If like, you have any, I'll start a website for this. Once, you fell on a bear.
Going to pee in the middle of the night, like going out to the outhouse. I fell on a sow with cubs. And
dude, you're alive?
Oh, well, yeah, they were alive. They were super alive.
No, you're alive.
Oh, no, like, no, I was dead. But isn't that weird? I fell on it? No.
That is crazy.
Yeah, I jumped up our whole flight of stairs in one jump. And the van, I was standing on the backs of Vans slip-ons, like checkered slip-ons.
Yep.
And I jumped, and this, I don't know how many steps it is, probably 8 or 10 steps. And the shoes were left there in the morning from when I jumped out of my shoes. I fell on the bear, and then I kind of, you know, sleepy.
Realized dark, that you made an alarming mistake.
Went, and it started, the bear moved, the mom. And then later we like went out and saw the prints and everything. I'm like, absolutely. We could do a whole podcast about that, my bear shit.
I would love to talk to you about that.
That's a story.
But I do want to write that
with
you.
It's a fun question,
sure.
though, to ask.
I want to hear that.
I don't know the dinner party download. I've heard of it. But.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun. Fun.
That's a great question, Dave.
So last question. We'll wrap it up. Any advice that you have for aspiring pro brewers or people that are home brewing now that, you know, possibly want to take it to the next level? And it doesn't even have to be on a professional level. Just do you have any advice for brewers, I guess?
Beer's fun. Advice would be that I can't say don't get into it because it's your hobby and it's fun, because I still am in the same boat. It is a hobby and a career, but I would make sure that you pay attention to like what your life trajectory is, mm-hmm. and what else you want to do, because it's going to consume everything.
Yeah, it's it's not just a full-time job. You're always thinking about it, because yeast is a living thing.
More than you would expect, mm-hmm. nowadays to be able to pull this thing off. Yeah, it better be a passion, mm-hmm. and a job.
Well, hey, thanks for being here. Is there anything you want to add?
I want you to be the first person to taste
that. Oh, yeah.
Beer.
Okay.
So we have a new beer coming out today, mm-hmm. Called Electric Berry Land, Blackberry version. We've done Electric Berry Land, I think, 4 versions. Yeah. That's gonna pop hard. Just don't rip the thing off there and then blow it all over the room. I know you love doing that, Dave.
I do love blowing it all over the room.
Or maybe it won't. Dave has really weak fingers.
Just wanted to have it by the mic.
No, Dave's a guitar player. He's got it figured out.
That's right.
So this is Blackberry Electric Berry Land. Released today.
Released today.
Highly carbonated.
Today is, what is today?
Between
anyway?
6 Today's months
the 18th
and
of April, 2017. So, okay, repeat that again.
Between 6 month and 3-year-old sour beer, and all different, like we were talking about, different blending.
If I had a website, I would post this this picture because it's pretty cool.
3 pounds per gallon Whatcom raspberries.
Nice.
From a wonderful dude named Rob.
Wonderful dude. Well, cheers. Thanks for sharing.
Thanks for having me on, dude.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's delicious. It's
jammy.
Got good, we were talking about these beers being too thin earlier. This has got nice body to it, but it still has that bright acidity that makes it feel thinner than it actually is, but it's still got some good body to it. This is really, really nice.
Thank you. I like the finish on this one.
Tastes like blackberry juice.
Yeah, it's real jam.
Fizz,
right?
And alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
Jam.
It's exciting, man. This is day one.
Yeah.
Pick and Thomas. The labels turned out cool.
So if you're local, you can get this at the North Fork Brewery.
Only there.
Deming, Washington, yep. On Mount Baker Highway. All right. Well, hey, Eric Jorgensen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah.
Love you, buddy.
Pleasure to have you. Eric Jorgensen, ladies and gentlemen. Funny, smart, and a damn fine brewer to boot. Hopefully you got to try some Electric Berryland, as it's probably close to gone by now. If you're local and haven't been out to the North Fork to sample his beers, you owe it to yourself to do it. I'm Dave Morales. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Tapped In. Tapped In is a production of Bellingham Tap Trail with content direction by Scott Pelton. See you next time. Cheers.